Hello, hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Older Adult to Geriatric Nutrition Answers podcast, presented to you by LongTermCareRD.com. I'm Michelle, your host and presenter of today's episode. So, we have a very, very exciting announcement. Long-Term Care RD is officially looking to expand into a membership site. Now, this has been something that's been asked of me for, I guess we're going towards 4 years at this point. And I would say for the past 3 years, people have asked me about exploring the idea of a membership. And I've kind of hummed and hawed about it, if I'm being totally honest, because a membership site is a lot of work if you want to give the participants the best quality. And I knew that if I wanted to start a membership site, I wanted to get it right the first time. And I'm finally in a position with the way the Long-Term Care RD is going that it is time to launch a membership site. So I'm really excited about it. But what I'm asking of you, if you're listening to this, is I want to know the demand before I go about building out an entire new website. I already have a significant amount of the resources built up, and the membership site would essentially be where everything is housed. It's almost like a library is what I would call it, a digital library for specifically clinical dietitians. And what we're going to be starting is it's going to be a division of longtermcarerd.com, but it's going to be housed under a separate domain, so a separate website. And this is simply because if you want to become a member, it will redirect you to a website that is solely dedicated to the membership website. It's nothing else. It's just a membership site. And what it's going to be is it is going to be your ultimate membership platform, and it is designed exclusively for clinical dietitians seeking to streamline their practice. So this innovative membership site is your one-stop resource. It is eliminating the need for time-consuming research when you're trying to find answers to how to treat a patient. It's going to have a comprehensive library right at your fingertips. You'll find everything from clinical nutrition resources, up-to-date clinical nutrition guidelines, evidence summaries, engaging webinars, and essential education topics. And it's going to have new things added to the library every single month. It's more than just a resource hub, though. It's going to be a community. We're looking to build in a group forum where discussions can be held. So you have a question about how to treat a patient, how to handle a work scenario. It's all going to be there. And your peers can give their insights. They can help you find the answers. I'm obviously going to be in this forum as well. And essentially, this is created by a practicing dietitian for practicing dietitians. I've always been the biggest advocate for that, and that is exactly where the Long-Term Care RD website came from. It was trying to find practical information, like just tell me what to do. Just tell me how much calories and protein I need to give a patient with a stage 2 pressure ulcer. It was things like that, and I didn't want to read through a ton of literature. I just wanted to know, and not just the textbook answer. Like, if you're a dietitian, you know that there's nuances to answers. And that's what this is going to be. It's a platform that's tailored to meet your professional needs. And it's making your job not just easier, but more impactful. You can see more patients if you don't have to do endless research. You can make more of a difference. So all I need from you is I'm starting a waitlist, and anybody that's on the waitlist is actually going to get a discounted rate when they join. And that's just kind of as a thank you. So even if the price of the membership goes up, you're always going to be charged the same rate so long as you stay a member. And it's going to have items that are in the shop currently on the website in the membership site. So you won't have to purchase things individually. It would just all be included. So all you have to do is just shoot me an email letting me know you want to be on the waitlist for the membership. It's as simple as that. There's no commitment. You don't have to pay anything. I don't need your credit card information. I just need your name and your email. That's it. So simple as that. So we do have a new email. The old one is still active, but the new email is simply just info@longtermcarerd.com. That's it. Simple as that. So if you are interested in being on the waitlist and being included in finding out more information when it's launching, all this kind of stuff, Just send me an email, info@longtermcarerd.com. You just got to give me your name and I'll obviously have your email, and that's it. So I am so excited. And as more information comes out about the membership site, I will certainly keep you guys updated. And when we get closer to a release date, I'm obviously going to give you that information as well. But I will continue to talk about it throughout the podcast episodes coming up in the future. But now we're going to get on to today's podcast episode. So I got a comment, or I saw a comment, where I was mentioned in the other day, and it was about how to treat a patient if nutrition interventions are no longer working. And I wanted to let you guys know that, yes, I do actually have an article about how to handle these situations. I actually have multiple articles because I've written about end of life quite consistently since the beginning of the long-term care RD. But I actually updated the article. It's entitled The Secrets to End of Life Eating Habits. And this is from a dietitian. It's for dietitians. But ultimately, dietitians do need to know, what do we do when somebody is simply just end of life? You know, like, nutrition interventions will not work. And so I wanted to give you guys some tips today just about how to handle those types of things, because they're end of life doesn't mean end of care, but it does mean that there's a shift in care, and it's obviously towards comfort care. So navigating these final chapters, it's a change in eating habits as well. And just because somebody's end of life doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to stop eating right away. But how do you handle it as a clinical dietitian in terms of what do we do, what do we document, things like that? And obviously this phase, it's very distressing for loved ones and the caregivers, but it's a normal part of the dying process. And the body simply has decreasing needs for sustenance. Now, understanding these changes, it's crucial to provide not only compassionate care that respects the natural course of the end of life, but it is also important that dietitians are well versed in what to do when nutrition interventions are just no longer working, because you're going to be the ones that are talking to the families. You're going to be the ones that are giving them that education piece so that they have more peace when they know what is going to come. So I do have a webinar, and it will be on the membership site, just a little plug there, on end-of-life nutrition. There's an ebook and a webinar that goes with it, and so I will link that in the show notes if you're looking for more conversational pieces. But essentially, what is end-of-life? End-of-life, it is actually an official diagnosis or proclamation only a doctor can make, but what we're basically saying at that point is that this person is expected to live for 6 months or less. And it will vary greatly in that 6 month period. Some people will live for literally weeks, and others might live for over that 6 months. With each human being, we cannot exactly predict what's going to happen, but there are signs and symptoms that we know will give us some level of indication as to when the timing is getting close. And it's actually quite interesting that nutrition signs and symptoms are actually one of the most notable signs that end of life is approaching. Particularly in dementia care, we see a lot of nutrition shifts early on that can give us an indication that end of life is nearing. So this makes the role of a dietitian in end of life eating habits essential, because it's not only a predictor that end of life discussions need to take place, but also that we need to start talking with the loved ones to prepare them. I have heard frequently from new dietitians that they're very uncomfortable having those end-of-life discussions, and I 100% understand that. End-of-life discussions are very difficult because, at least from my experience, we don't get training in it, which makes it incredibly difficult to know how to brace for those conversations, as there's not really an education piece to them. But the more education that you seek out in how to have these discussions, the more comfortable you're going to feel having them. Because as a dietitian, especially those that are working in geriatric care, long-term care, these types of fields, you need to know how to have them, because that's the last stop in the road for somebody. An end of life is an inevitable finish to living in long-term care. So I really recommend, if you're a dietitian, even a new one looking for more end-of-life education, really seek it out, because it is important that you know how to have these discussions. And honestly, you'll get more comfortable with it the more times you have the conversation. I'm not saying that it necessarily gets easier, but you will feel more prepared to go into those discussions. So when we look at understanding the end-of-life eating habits, so when end-of-life approaches, the body really does undergo significant changes. And we see just a natural decline in appetite and obviously nutrition needs. So this phase is often characterized by decreased desire for food and fluids. And this can be really distressing for loved ones, caregivers, these types of things. But it's normal. And so some of the most common changes we see is obviously that physiological shift. And this is essentially the body's way of preparing for death. The transition involves a slowdown in the metabolic function, so the body's demand for energy decreases, and it can be significant at times, and it can be fast. So if it's a little slower, though, you might just see a patient that has just a decreased interest in food and drink. It doesn't hold the same appeal for them. They don't really want to. And we might see it look like things like skipping meals. If they're nonverbal, they might just simply keep their mouth closed when people are trying to offer them food or fluids. Or they'll be pushing food to the side, they'll push utensils to the side. We might see them preferring only drinks, they might be sleeping through mealtimes more, and obviously these ones are going to result in unintentional weight loss, so we do see a decline in weight in some patients. They might have a preference for just smaller meals, less frequent, or maybe more frequent, but they're a lot smaller, more snack size. They might be favoring liquids and soft foods over solid ones just because it's easier to consume them, as well as a noticeable decline in both thirst and hunger, which can lead to that minimal intake. Specific cravings or desire for certain comfort foods, often those that hold kind of a sentimental value to them, so their favorite foods, family foods, things like that. And when we get to the end, it's a complete loss of interest in eating and drinking as the body does prepare for that end of life period. So when we see the reduced food and fluid intake, all of the cues that I mentioned will obviously result in a decrease in food and fluid intake, and it normally won't meet what we typically say were their caloric daily requirements under normal circumstances, so when they're not in an end-of-life period. But as the body is going through the dying process and resting more, the caloric requirements, they simply decrease naturally. So it's a natural response to the body's changing needs. And it's important to recognize that this decrease, it's not akin to the hunger or thirst experienced by normal healthy individuals. Instead, it's simply a part of the body's preparation for a peaceful and natural passing. Forcing of those food and fluids can actually lead to a lot more discomfort, which can include nausea, extreme bloating, respiratory issues, just because the body is not equipped to process and utilize them as effectively. So when we look at the nutrition needs and comfort care, the focus shifts from meeting nutrition goals, so their calorie goals, their protein goals, to comfort measure. The aim of this part is simply to ensure that the individual's remaining time is as comfortable as possible and as dignified as possible. This might mean simply offering meals, but if they decline, accepting that they do not want to eat at that time. And understanding this can really help families to really recognize that end of life is coming, and that what we're trying to do is we are trying to make them as comfortable as possible and valuing quality of life, that we're not just, you know, starving them, which is what some families may feel. So it does help to know what some of the common concerns and misconceptions are. So misconception number one that I hear from families is that they're starving, or the family member feels like they're starving because they're not eating. And this is one of the most distressing thoughts for families, is that their loved one is so, so hungry. However, you can educate them that the sensation of hunger typically diminishes as the body prepares for the end of life. So this natural decrease in appetite means that the individual does not experience hunger in the same way that you or I may. And the body's decreased demand for energy or calories results in a corresponding decrease in the need for food. A second misconception is that they are dehydrated. Similarly, concerns about dehydration often arise when fluid intake decreases. Now, while hydration is vital for a healthy, active body, the needs change significantly during the end-of-life phase, so the sensation of thirst diminishes, and the body may no longer process fluids effectively. So excessive fluids can actually, again, it can lead to that increased discomfort, which includes swelling, congestion, increased risk of aspiration or respiratory issues. And another very common misconception is that artificial nutrition increases comfort, so the tube feeding. We know, and this is confirmed by really good research, that giving feeding tubes or IV nutrition is generally not recommended because it can often do more harm than good. As the body prepares for death, its ability to process and use nutrients is not as efficient as it once was. So, just like force feeding and force drinking, it will lead to increased discomfort, bloating, nausea, increased risk of infections, and it may extend the dying process but not improve the quality of life, which obviously will potentially cause additional distress for not only the patient but their loved one. And so understanding those common misconceptions, and I can assure you that those are three of the most common ones that you will hear as a dietitian. So what we want to shift then is we want to shift to what are the practical tips for end-of-life nutrition, because we're no longer trying to meet nutrition goals to keep nutrition optimized. Instead, what we're trying to do is improve quality of life for however long they may have. And so what we want to do is we want to focus on these things. So we're going to offer smaller, more frequent meals. Now, this is so long as they are accepting, because offering large meals, it can feel very daunting and overwhelming. And so you can try to give them a variety of foods with no pressure. If they want to eat, they're welcome to eat, but if they don't, that is their choice. We also want to pay attention to their favorite foods. So when we're talking to loved ones, instead of having them worry about, you know, the person eating gigantic meals to meet their nutrition needs, instead, we can encourage them, you know what, if there's any pastries that your loved one really enjoyed, maybe bring those in. And if a patient's gotten to the point, though, where they're not eating anymore, we can shift the focus again, that instead of focusing on food when you come to visit your loved one, maybe there's something that they love to do. Maybe just talk to them. Maybe show them old pictures. If they're not fully awake, maybe let's just play music that they loved. The focus doesn't always have to be on eating and drinking, because that may distress the loved one that they're always concerned about that. So try to take the focus off of meeting nutrition needs, and let's try to just give them a pleasant environment. So managing symptoms that affect eating. So we want to look at those things that are causing dry mouth or difficulty swallowing at end of life. This may be just keeping the mouth moist with ice chips, special mouthwashes, toothettes, which can be dipped into fluids and put in the mouth. Doctors will look at anti-nausea medication if they're still taking medication. We just want to do whatever we can to make them comfortable within our realm of nutrition. We also want to create a pleasant and non-forceful eating environment. So this means that there is no pressure at mealtimes, that they're listening to the tune of their body, whether they want to eat or not. Also encouraging independence where they still have it, if they're able to. Now, I just want to clear up a misconception here, though. Like, it does sound like I'm talking about somebody that is still alert and conscious. And yes, when somebody is end of life, they can still be alert and conscious and eating and drinking. When they get more towards the stage where they're sleeping more and they're not conscious anymore, obviously this will not be your focus, creating a pleasant dining environment. But if somebody has 6 months to live, I can assure you that they are still going to be needing these tips. So I just want to clear up that misconception that end of life means they're going to die within a day or two. No, they still may live 6 months. They might even live 7 or 8 months. But it's a typical prediction that we see, especially when there's multiple chronic diseases that are leading to that, right? Just wanted to clear that up. And of course, we want to be flexible with mealtimes. So they are listening to their bodies, and we're going to be as flexible as we can within the parameters of, if they're living in long-term care, obviously we do have mealtimes that are set, but maybe there's ways that you can set aside food for them that's available to them for when they are actually hungry, because we don't want to force them to eat at a time where they don't want to eat. And lastly, we really want to encourage hydration. Hydration, while they're still accepting, it's important, but like with food, it's essential to follow their cues. So you can be offering small sips of water, very small ice chips or moist fruits to keep them comfortable. But again, we're going to avoid forcing them as this can lead to discomfort. So I just want to wrap up with the last part, which is what to do when all nutrition interventions stop working, because this was where the question came from that started this whole article posting and episode. So accepting that nutrition interventions are no longer beneficial, it marks a pivotal moment in the care of individuals at the end of life. The realization typically comes when it's clear that your nutrition interventions no longer contribute to the patient's comfort or well-being, and may in fact actually detract from the quality of their remaining days. We want to recognize that this requires careful observation as well as communication with healthcare team who can offer insight into the science indicating that the body is naturally reducing its need for food and fluids as a part of the dying process. This is going to include doctors, nurses, healthcare aides, all of those of us that work within a hospice care team. And as a dietitian, I strongly encourage get on that hospice care team because you are a pivotal part of it. And then, of course, once you've convened with the team and you're all on the same page, that's when the conversation with the family gets initiated. You should not take an end-of-life initiative without discussing it with your team first, because you do not want to be the only one that's thinking that it's end-of-life and it's not, okay? But one clear indicator that nutrition interventions have stopped working is that just continual persistent decline in appetite, interest in food, despite every single attempt at nutritional support. This change is often accompanied by the body's decreased ability to digest and absorb nutrients. It leads to discomfort and adverse effects such as nausea, bloating, fluid overload. Now, when these signs become evident, it's really crucial to consult with your care team to reassess the goals of care. If somebody is in resuscitation or a medical care, yet they're end of life, then there needs to be a conversation had, especially if, let's say, the family does not want artificial nutrition or they've made it very clear that a tube feed is not on the table. Okay, then we need to shift this probably to a comfort care advanced care directive, because at that point we're focusing on symptom management and quality of life rather than on sustaining or extending life through artificial means. So accepting this shift in care priorities, it can be very emotionally challenging for families and caregivers who view providing food and hydration as fundamental acts of care. However, when we transition to a comfort-focused approach, so we're emphasizing pain relief, emotional support, alleviation of symptoms, it can actually offer a much more peaceful and dignified end-of-life experience. So we really want to have those open, honest discussions about what to expect with end of life. We expect a decline in food and fluid intake. We may see some weight loss depending how long they live as their appetite and intake decreases. Always be open and honest, because the more that you can prepare a family as a dietitian for what the end of life journey looks like, the more peaceful they'll be when these symptoms start to flare up, when they start to see that their loved one is no longer eating, when they start to see weight loss. So it's really important that we do have these discussions, because you can be such an important part of the team to relieve these worries that they may have. So I'm going to link in the show notes the article that I wrote, because there's a lot more to it. I give specific examples at the end of the article and information just for dietitians, like how long can somebody live without food and fluids? What's the end of life dehydration process look like? What is the benefits and burdens of the artificial nutrition, parenteral and enteral nutrition? So, and I also do have articles linked there that are actually giving you talking points. So I really encourage you to take a look at that. Thanks for listening to today. Sorry that the episode wasn't up yesterday. I had some technical issues. Don't forget, send me an email if you want to be on the waitlist for the membership site, info@longtermcarerd.com. I will put that in the show notes for you. Thanks so much for the support, everybody. I love everybody who shows up and listens to this podcast weekly. It's so appreciated, and I hope you have a wonderful week and a great first day of spring.